And here we are back with a little bit more, actually a lot more Babylon podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
I am Jeremy Heide.
I'm Matt.
Matt.
Just Matt.
Just Matt.
Matt.
Darth Matt.
Oh, come on, Darth Matt. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, how you found the Babylon podcast, how you found Babylon 5. Introduce yourself, sir.
Yes.
Well, I found the Babylon podcast many moons ago from the wonderful website ISNnews.net, which is still on the air and still does great science fiction news. And I think they had been kind of just covering you when you had started your show. And I think I found you when you were in the early teens, I want to say. And I've listened on and off through the years. So I've been listening to the Babylon podcast for a long time. Through your highs and your lows and your various audio qualities. And
yes.
Wow, that sounded like a zing at Tim's landline.
Yes.
And as far as Babylon 5 goes, you know, I remember, you know, staying up in the middle of the night and, you know, catching these weird shows on TV. And originally, I didn't like Babylon 5 because it pushed Star Trek back. Hour because they put Babylon 5 in the 10:30 slot on Saturday night, and then they moved Star Trek, I think Deep Space Nine, back because or Next Generation. I don't remember what was airing in there at that time. And you know, for my original reactions, poo, I do not like you. And then
wow, what perfect world were you living in?
Yeah, well, it was it was even airing. I lived near Sioux City, Iowa at the time. If you'll remember, this was the only station in the country that told the Late Show with David Letterman, we don't need you. We'll keep airing Star Trek The Next Generation rather at 10 o'clock at night rather than airing you.
Wow.
Yeah. And this was from a popular vote among the people they surveyed.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, Western Iowa had a pretty strong Star Trek community at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I don't even remember this call letters, the station anymore, whatever channel 14 was at that time. So, you know, eventually, I think it was in season two, it was a call to the wilderness that I really started like realizing that Babylon 5, there was something to it. It's like that shot of the great machine, you know, stolen directly from Forbidden Planet, which I didn't figure out till years later. That shot is like really taught me like, oh, Babylon 5, there is something to this. And, you know, I didn't never really catch up on the first season until much later. And it was really the second season of the show that brought me in, which is what, to this day, is what I tell most people who start Babylon 5 and don't get it. I'm like, don't worry about the first season. If you don't like it, just skip to the second season. It's generally easier to go back if you're having trouble than just to plow through that first season and hate it.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
I hope that explains things.
Very nice. Very nice.
Well, okay.
Glad that you stuck with us. Glad that you volunteered to talk about our topic for the evening, which we'll get to in a little bit. But a couple little things that I wanted to mention here before we go much farther. As you people may or may not know by now, America's first female astronaut, Sally Ride, has passed away at the age of 61. She had a losing bout with pancreatic cancer. But, you know, she, a little bit of history, she was one of the first six women who were chosen in the shuttle program for the astronaut specialist program. And she joined in 1978, which is kind of amazing to think about how long ago that was. She flew into space on Challenger on June 18th in 1983, and she also served on the inquest board after the Challenger disaster. She went on to found her own foundation, the Sally, I'm looking here for the name of it so I can get it right, Sally Ride Science, and it was aimed at students in middle school and high school to stick with interests in science and pursue science-related careers. So she was a very, very active woman in promoting science and the space program. So she will be missed.
Oh, man.
She's the same age as my mother is now. It's kind of scary when you think about how young people can die.
Yeah, right, mm-hmm. Right.
I remember reading her book in grade school, you know, first female American astronaut, and it's just one of those things. And I think the unfortunate truth, though, I don't think a lot of people really knew a lot about Sally Wright after her initial odyssey into space. Hopefully the only good thing that might come out of this, people will take the time to remember her and acknowledge her accomplishments.
Yep. Yeah. One thing that I would point out, because it's interesting, I was reading a couple, small articles on the website, and she's, as I said, America's first female astronaut, but not the first woman to go into space. That honor went to Valentina Tereshkova. Hope I pronounced that right. Sorry to all our Russian listeners there if I've mangled that. And she flew into space in 61 or 62, I don't remember. But the difference there is that Tereshkova's voyage was very much a PR stunt on the part of the Soviet space program at the time. She was a factory worker who I think was like a parachutist as a hobbyist. Sally Ride was definitely someone chosen for her qualifications. You know, the fact that she was female in many ways is secondary to the fact that she was, you know, a qualified, she held a doctorate and, you know, reading through some of this.
Well, and it's part of the legacy of the shuttle too, that when we had this larger vehicle that had a larger crew, we could have people that weren't military right. pilots going into space. And you know, that's unfortunately something we've lost now too.
Yeah.
At least for the time being.
Right. So anyways, so that's a thing that's important to note as well. So anyways, the other bit of news to pass on, which might be news, as it were, by the time you hear this. Coming up this weekend, Curiosity rover is slated to land on red planet Mars this coming weekend, which we are recording this on the 25th of July. One of the things that the NASA scientists have done and the mission controllers is they maneuvered the two-decade-old Mars Odyssey orbiter into an orbit that will allow it to relay signals from Curiosity in near real time, which is something that it would not have been possible given to the location on the planet that Curiosity is landing in relation to how the planet would be rotated facing toward Earth. So, they're expecting, I'm looking here, but maybe not this weekend. The confirmation of landing should be received on Earth August 6th. So I guess it's not this weekend, but following weekend. Anyways, that's exciting news.
Oh, yeah. It should be an exciting landing, too, if it actually works. Like, you know, putting those rockets and then dropping the thing via cables onto the ground. I mean, that's why they needed to move. Odyssey into orbit, and why they wanted. You know, Odyssey's been having a heck of a time these last few weeks because it keeps going into safe mode because they're not sure what's wrong with it and it's old.
Yep.
So hopefully it lasts through long enough to get Curiosity on the ground.
Right. And part of the reason they want Odyssey to relay the signals is so they don't sit there here on Earth wondering, well, it was it successful or wasn't it? You know, they kind of want to know as soon as they possibly can, which makes sense. So there's a little bit of news for you. Anybody else got anything you want to contribute before we take a break?
I believe, if Twitter is correct, that today is the birthday of one of our early guest contributors, Ms. Myrtle Lafferty.
Is it?
It's what Twitter's telling me.
Twitter wouldn't lie.
Twitter can't lie. Or it self-corrects very quickly if it's mistaken.
That's one way to put it. Yeah, right. Well, happy birthday, Murr.
Yeah, happy birthday from us over here at the Babylon Podcast. And I believe that's all I have.
All right. Jeremy, you got anything?
Nope. Same old, same old.
All right. Matt, do you have anything you want to add to?
Well, I don't know what you talked about last week, if you talked about all the Studio JMS stuff or not, but I assume you did. So
yes, we did indeed.
And all that excitement, because that's pretty awesome, and hopefully something good comes out of it.
Yep.
But that would be all I have.
Okay. Well, if you have more, you can always leave a message on the voicemail line.
Oh, is that working again?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's working
Thank
again.
Thank you. Thank you.
I believe Gary actually may have left some messages this week.
Yep.
Possibly. Okay.
Somebody, there's messages there. I haven't listened to them yet.
Man, I'm thinking of the Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja's voicemail. I'll be honest. I do get the two shows confused once in a while.
The Kick-Ass Mystic Ninja's voicemail line went away probably sometime in 2008.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And Neil said he only left three messages today for us. So okay. We are going to have a good feedback palooza.
Excellent.
I hope.
Excellent. Yeah.
Well, we always do.
All right, Jeremy, take us out for a break, and we'll come right back and let Matt lead this caravan, this wagon train through the... Yeah, wagon train would be a good NL.
Well, yeah. I think you hired John Candy, and we'd lead this land.
Hey,
all right.
Hey, we will get from A point A to A point B, so let's get going here.
Who am I? I am Susan Ivanova, commander, daughter of Andrei and Sophie Ivanov. I am the right hand of vengeance, and the boot that is going to kick your sorry ass all the way back to Earth, sweetheart. I am death incarnate, and the last living thing that you are ever going to see. God sent me.
And we're back to talk about the non-canonical novels. Well, the first batch. The first batch. The first nine numbered novels were... had a rather lukewarm reception, would you say?
At best.
It seems nobody really liked them, including JMS at the end. Give him credit, he defended them until Better came along. But I think even at the time, I don't think he was ever quite happy, judging from his post on Genie and Usenet.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know quite where to begin. We've got in the numbered books, now that also includes The Shadow Within and To Dream in the City of Sorrows. But we're dealing with those separately because those are now considered officially canon novels. We've got otherwise the seven other books here. The titles are Voices by John Vornholt, Accusations by Lois Tilton, Blood Oath by John Vornholt, Clark's Law by Jim Mortimer, The Touch of Your Shadow, The Whisper of Your Name by Neil Barrett Jr., Betrayals by S.M. Serling, and Personal Agendas by Al Sarantonio.
Now, Personal Agendas we're not touching on this week. You guys are saving that till next week, correct?
No, Shadow Within and To Dream the City of Sorrow. So Personal Agendas is right for... And actually, here's the thing. I tried reading Voices some years back and got about as far as the point where Talia goes to visit the Indians and decided I just really can't read any more of this.
The fake Indians?
Yeah.
I've read all these books, going back a decade, and I haven't read them, most of them. When you said, hey, come on, I'm like, I'm going to read all these. And the only one I got through was Voices. So most of this is heavily from memory or from leaning heavily on the Lurker's Guide and their summaries.
I have to be honest. My plan was to read through all nine books.
Yeah.
I got through the first one again because I had gotten through it before.
Yep.
I got halfway through the second one. And I started the third one, and I realized that I couldn't continue.
I will say this for voices.
I don't remember them being quite that, what's the word I'm looking for?
God-awful?
No, trust me. I have read god-awful sci-fi and fantasy. These are not god-awful. They're just...
Well, I'll tell you. Here's the thing.
Yes.
That's an excellent word, Jeremy. Absolutely. I was reading through the synopsis, fairly detailed synopsis on the Lurker's Guide, and a lot of these are someone on the station is being framed for some other crime, and they have to prove their innocence. And there's a B story going on, which has nothing to do with the A story, and a riot breaks out all over the station.
They also feel like mashups of other episodes a lot of times. Like, it feels like Mind War, or not Mind War, yeah, Mind War to some degree. Eyes is being cited a lot. Like, there are always, like, these secret investigations from Earth coming in, and somebody, you know, some alien presence is causing trouble. Midnight on the firing line.
And here's the thing about Voices that struck me when, what was it, a couple years ago when I flipped through all of them again to get my information straight when I was fact-checking the information for the Chronologies book. Except for the side trip to Mars, or to Earth rather, for you know, Talia going to Arizona, that was almost beat for beat just like the episode Survivors.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that didn't hit me until when I was flipping through it this time, I'm like, wait, how did I not see this before?
Yeah. And Voices has a lot of kind of, I think the telepaths are usually pretty well done in Voices, but like the humans that aren't like Garibaldi, Sheridan, Ivanova, the voice doesn't sound right in my head. Like the dialogue doesn't seem like it's not quite there, which is something I would say is true of almost all these novels. The command staff always feels just not quite right in their dialogue. I mean, that's because we hear so much more dialogue from them than anyone else through the show that you have a better ear for it.
In some cases, their actions aren't true to who we know they are. And I think that's what pulls us out of being able to enjoy the books as much as we probably could have. I mean, because you think about, I mean, how many decades have there been Star Trek novels?
Oh, forever.
Yeah. For all of the franchises. And I can't even begin to count how many Star Wars novels there are. It's the same thing. There's just, I think we will overlook ordinary stories if the characterizations are on point. And for these first 9 books, for the most part.
For these first 6 plus 8, mostly.
Well, yeah, number 6 and number 8, you know, 1 through 6 and 8. For the majority of these first 9 books, that's the problem. The characterizations aren't as familiar. They don't ring as true.
Well, I'll tell you, here's the where I ran aground with Voices as much as anything, and your comments I think are spot on as well, because not to delve into it too much, one of the things that I loved especially about the Greg Key's PsyCorps novels is that he has Bester spot on. You can really hear that voice. But the other part of it is that these are novels that supposedly take place between the events of this episode and that episode. But because they're not part of the fabric of the show, they can't help but really at the end hitting the reset button. So in a lot of ways, it's full of sound and fury, but signifying nothing. And as we all know, one of the great appeals to Babylon 5 is that as the story is told and the plots are woven, that what has preceded impacts what comes next. And Voices is a good example. If all that was going on, why couldn't we have that in the show to begin with? And it's not in the show, so it just feels like it's sort of an adventure story that's sandwiched in between other things. And for me, that's the problem. It's like this doesn't have any impact on the universe around.
So you're saying there's no character development?
Right.
There can't be.
Or very
little.
And if it is supposedly something that officially happens, well, as we know now, they've since been declared non-canonical. If it's such a big event, you would think that somewhere in the show, given the verisimilitude that it tries to project in terms of characters changing, somebody would say, hey, you remember that time when Talia went to visit the Indians? You know, and none of that ever shows up. So that also takes.
Or maybe Deuce comes back and calls in his favor from her. Yeah, that would be something that would make sense to come up in the show. You know,
Now the other thing that reading through the synopsis, the one that really I think is an interesting concept that I would like to have seen differently. There's the last of the non-canonical numbered books. However, when it's described, called Personal Agendas, the write up is that it takes place basically in the events of the beginning of the fourth season, where Shakar is imprisoned on Centauri Prime, and he struck his deal with Londo to kill Cartagia for Londo in exchange for the freedom of Narn. But in the novel, there's a group of former Narn slaves who are sworn to free Jakar. And, of course, the deal, you know, the conflict comes in that if these Narn free Jakar, then the deal is soured. And, you know, but Jakar won't be able to save his people by sacrificing himself, in essence. But of course, you know, what happens, you read the synopsis, they get to Jakar, Jakar tries to tell him, no, you can't kidnap me, and Londo shows up, so they kidnap Londo instead, and then there's this, okay, well, you know, we've got Jakar, and you've got Londo, and we're gonna swap, and Ivanova and Garibaldi and Franklin disguise themselves as jewel traders to get on Centauri Prime to see if they can't put everything back together the way it was, and it's just sort of, it's almost like the Scooby-Doo scenes where everybody's running down through the hall of doors kind of thing. You know, there's this, and in the end, of course, nothing changes because Jakar's back in a cell and Londo's freed and everybody agrees nobody can ever say a word about this. So I'm reading this and it's like, and here's the thing. What if we had gotten the novel about the Narns who go to free Jakar, but they never get anywhere near Jakar. Let's, you know, give us a Babylon 5 novel that's set in the universe, but doesn't have anything to do with the major characters as we know from the show.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely something that they never really did with any of the novels. They didn't just find a random facet of the universe and just take a tangent and go with it. Which, it does seem like these novels are very formulaic in fiction universe. You know, we want the main characters to do something, we don't want it to have consequence, and when it's done, it'll all wrap up. I think for Personal Agendas, I know JMS, you know, because this is the part, the last three books JMS personally, like, did an outline for and gave them to the authors, and I think the problem with this one was there just wasn't enough time to... they realized it wasn't a great book, but they didn't really want to say, we're not going to publish it. Which, take that for what you will.
Well, and if you read the synopses here on the Lurker's Guide, there are, like, all the Lurker's Guide pages where JMS speaks. He has his comments, and one of the running threads throughout is... I give the broad definition. They run with it. I don't have time to be an editor to catch the stuff that says this is not working right for the universe.
One of the other things JMS, going into the JMS wrote, like about Clark's Law, that I'm going to quote directly. In most cases, the writer sends in a proposal for the book to the book company, and then these proposals get sent to me, which if I like them or if it fits in a storyline in one way or another, then the book is commissioned. I work with the writer to one degree or another and keeping these things very much on track. In the case of this book, Clark's Law, I actually had very little to do until the actual manuscript came in, at which time I made my notes and suggestions, so the lion's share of the compliments must go to the author. So that's kind of a sense of how this process was going. There's a couple other notes if you go through JMS News where he's, they're openly soliciting for authors to step forward and take part, and that was not an uncommon thing on Usenet in those times. So,
yeah. And for the final book of the personal agendas, even though it's 8, here's the thing that JMS is quoted on Lurker's Guide. It says, anyway, as I said, it's okay, but for my money, the Anna Sheridan and Jeffrey Sinclair books are the two real gems of this batch.
And this is true. They're both very good books.
Yeah. So.
Someone's actually drawing up my quotes from up on IRC. Oh, that's quick.
So, what do we take away from this? I mean, I think our general consensus that these aren't really worth anyone's time.
I think it's kind of what do you want? If you really, really want new Babylon 5,
never ask that question.
you know, there's gems in
it. Hey, I still have hope that JMS's new studio might actually produce some comics or something, but there are little tidbits in some of these books.
Like in Clark's Law, there's a great scene where, Franklin has to go into EVA and save this zero gravity crane worker, and they're worried. And you got this whole scene that's playing out in zero gravity, and you got a crane that's going to crash into the station, and you're dealing with, multiple objects moving in different directions, with different ones rotating and ones spinning through space. And there's some really cool scenes and set pieces in these books. I mean, that's not all bad. And as much as one might malign Touch of Your Shadow, Whisper of Your Name for its title, it's it's an interesting concept, and there's good ideas that, there are things in the universe even the Vorlons don't understand, which is really cool in and of itself. Something that we don't ever really explore much in the series, I mean, unless you count the Third Space movie, in which at that point the Vorlons are gone, so they can't be like, ooh, pretty.
And there's a novel that never got published that I would love to read, simply because I know the author who wrote it. So,
which novel's that?
Third Space. JMS rejected the novelization of Third Space because he did not like the direction that the author took it in.
That's interesting. Because yes. Not to be overly critical, but I didn't think a lot of the Peter David summaries were the greatest things either. And they weren't bad. It just wasn't anything to write home about.
Yeah, for the record, for the people who don't know, the author who was contracted to write the novelization for Third Space is Yvonne Navarro, so who has some experience writing horror and suspense and science fiction.
And I know a lot of people who've gotten books not published.
Yeah, I know. Matt Stover apparently did a reboot of Flash Gordon that everybody loved except King World. And it literally would have done for Flash Gordon what Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins did for Batman.
Wow.
That's how mind-blowing it was. And King World just went, what?
Yeah, we can't have things that are successful.
Right. But no, there is I think it's an it's either in Voices or Accusations. There's a literally, it's a throwaway line, but it shines such a light on where the relationship between Susan and Talia could have gone.
Right. And I think that's an accusation.
Is it an accusation? I know it's one of those.
Accusations is the one they really get together. I mean, there's a little bit of that in Voices when Ivanova becomes her advocate, but I think she actually, like, Talia actually scans Ivanova in Accusations.
Yeah,
which
no,
is
there's
obviously
a,
all kinds of non-canon, but.
Right. But there was a line in there where actually Susan actually thinks about how she really feels about Talia, and it was just such a casually thrown away line, but it meant so much more to what we saw of them that we didn't get in the series. And I was like, how was this a throwaway line in a book that maybe 0.1% of the Babylon 5 fans are ever going to read?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it was felt back in pasta. This is a throwaway because nobody's going to
read it.
And it wasn't the deep scan. For some reason, I have this thought of this image in my head of Ivanova checking something out in somebody's fighter. And she's thinking about Talia at that moment.
That's Accusations, because okay. Accusations is the one with, you know, her old flight instructor shows up, and or he sends her a message like, I need help. And it turns out that he's discovered some super awesome metal, like I think it's called Morbonium.
Morbidium.
Yes.
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 It's right.
Horrible name. It's also used to make weapons because it's more.
Yes, exactly. And then there's this super morbidium. I'm kind of looking through the thing here. Oy vey.
But basically, he shows up, and he dies, and oh no, Susan's attached to the murderer because, you know, she knew him, and she was like the last person he talked to. So
right.
So yeah, obviously,
and the scene you're thinking of comes right towards the end of the novel when she's finally, you know, she figures out because of Talia, I think it is, that the thing that she needs to figure out the case has been put on her Star Fury.
Yeah. And it was in that, and I don't even remember the exact line, but I remember reading it, stopping, reading it again, and going, holy crap, are you kidding me? What's this doing in here?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, then that kind of goes to, you know, lost opportunities too in the whole Tala's last episode when they just messed up the coverage. Otherwise, the kiss scene would have been in there too.
Yeah, true. And the thing is I would have. I wish that
Peter David.
And his wife. I wish their hands weren't quite so tied. Because remember, we tried to pull answers out them about the novels, and they're like, we can't talk about it.
Yes. Right.
I mean, whatever document they signed in blood, you know, the NSA has nothing on the publisher.
Well, judging from reading Peter Davis' website, I think he signs quite a few non-disclosure agreements because he ends up writing a lot of movie novelizations.
No, you don't understand. These are books that are out of print. These are books that were published.
The reason why they can't be printed again, apparently.
Yeah,
15 yeah, there has years to be some ago. Reason.
15 years ago. All right. Why can't we find out more about the process of how these books were published? Because I don't know, maybe if we had waited until season 3, we would have gotten some better novels.
I don't know. And that's a good point. I think with the exception of Personal Agendas, I think for the most part these were written into season 2, beginning of season 3.
Yeah, they're all published between February of 95 and
Dream May of the City of Sirius.
Yeah, if you don't count
97.
And then the other three were written or published in 97, so
yeah.
Yeah, they all have a very first season vibe to them. like the authors watched the first season of Babylon 5. Okay, here's the new characters here. Because you get the, and then they seen like the first two or three episodes of season two where Garibaldi and Sheridan are kind of at loggerheads. Because that's a common theme through most of these books, like Sheridan and Garibaldi aren't getting along. So, or they come to some, you know, mutual understanding at some point. So it's unfortunate that it feels just like a lot of those throwaway episodes in season one. No, they're not throwaway episodes, but the episodes that don't feel as heavy, I guess would be the polite way of saying it. Yeah. That's kind of how I feel about Voices or Accusations or Blood Oath.
Yeah, Blood Oath is another one. That's in a lot of ways a rehashing of or expansion of the Parliament of Dreams subplot with the Sean Carr, because it's the family of Durag again that Shakar was had framed, and so we get another Blood Oath against Shakar, and Londo is used to. He has some information that will get allow a some sort of subterfuge, if you will, to trick somebody to thinking that Shakar is dead and or has knowledge that will get, you know, they have to agree to this to eliminate the Blood Oath and everything's fine again. Somebody got a hold of Parliament of Dreams and said, okay, well, let's make that a bigger story, you know, and there's nothing much more beyond that. Anyway.
No, there's really not. There's a little bit of going to Narn and murder and betrayal, and it's unfortunate. Clark's Law isn't bad as far as what it is. It's kind of goofy, but where we have, you know, Clark wants to reinstate the death penalty, and then you have this magical alien race that wants to sing, and their song is interrupted. Now they must steal the song of someone else, for then they can live again.
Which means they gotta go kill somebody.
Yeah. And it's at least it's a kind of science fiction-y premise. And that may be the other part that I think may these novels don't do, is it doesn't feel like you're really elevating science fiction in the way Babylon 5 does. Uh-huh. It just feels like very generic, pulpy, and not necessarily pulp science fiction, but it doesn't feel deep in any way.
Yeah. Oh, it feels like merchandise as opposed to real storytelling.
And this was something else I was kind of thinking about, too, and looking through comments, is I wonder if these six novels, how much that influenced when JMS came to the Mongoose books a few years ago, and when they wanted to publish stuff back in 2005, I think it was. Because, you know, they were kind of, we're a bunch of people, we got the Babylon 5 license, we want to publish some books. And JMS was like, well, we'll try. And you got the, you know, judging from his comments, he did really try to make them, you know, as canon as he had time to help with.
Right.
And they just didn't, you know, they never met the standards that he wanted for Babylon 5 books. And, you know, he has enough weight at Warner Brothers, he probably made sure that they couldn't publish those books. I mean, that's part of the reason why Peter David can't talk about either, is because whatever force he's thrown around to keep people from publishing these books, that's part of the reason that nobody's published any books, because that's just the way it is, because JMS doesn't have time to oversee them.
So basically, we need to find someone who is familiar with and is passionate about the Babylon 5 universe, as JMS is, to be the, shall we say, dominatrix of fact-checking, making sure that the books are up to our Babylon 5 standards.
I'm sure
what pops to mind?
Oh, go ahead.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I can't trust an adult to take over the factory when I'm gone. I need a child.
I think if Fiona Avery was up for it, he would trust her to do it. But I don't know what she's doing these days.
Yeah, and I don't know what that relationship there is between the two of them.
Well, I just know she did the fact-checking during Babylon 5 Age, and obviously trusted her to write scripts for Crusade and so forth.
Yeah,
so I think if anyone has enough command of the canon, because T'Kin really hasn't expanded significantly since that time, let's be honest.
Right.
But it would be nice, you know, it would be nice if there was someone out there. And maybe eventually with, you know, JMS Studios and the continued script book publishing that right. eventually some, you know, will get books published through those means.
I hope so. And again, I go back to like I said,
because you did an interview with the script book people a while back where you basically asked them flat out, would they publish books? And they said, we'd like to, but we can't yet.
Right. Well, again, personal agendas, I think, is partway there. It would be very interesting to see the Babylon 5 universe through a different set of characters, even if it was things that are concurrent to those episodes. But there's no reason why you have to have those main, quote-unquote, famous characters involved.
No, just take some random character that showed up once and write us, like, isn't there a short story about the human telepath and the that goes to Mimbar? Or am I imagining
things? No, right, right. The lady that was...
That would have been a great novel. Like, if someone would flush that out into a full novel, that would have been, you know, a good exploration of Mimbari society, akin to Dream in the City of Sorrows, which also was a good exploration of Mimbari society. You know, you could flush it out more with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that would be neat. I think that would be great novels going forward. I'd love to see something like that. And then that gives you the ability to, you know, some of the things I remember are coming now. I'm getting a little off base maybe here, but, our interview with Jean Cavellos, you know, she talked about with the Technomage books, Straczynski gave her the outline, but things like the spell casting techniques, the actual mechanics of that, that was all hers. And it worked very nicely with the Babylon 5 universe. So I think, other novels would give you the opportunity to expand on some stuff and, you know, stay away from cliched stuff like, oh, you know, people are after morbidium and super morbidium to make super weapons. You know, that's not, they're, I have no interest in that, you know, no. And let's not frame people for stuff. Let's have them involved in, you know, things that,
or maybe like a good novelization like the Dilgar War would have been something fun that would have really flushed out the Babylon 5 universe.
Right.
Now that could have been a lot of fun to read.
Yeah.
Oh, they should have come out with laser tag. That, like one side's purple.
Now you laugh. But if you had come out with laser tag sets where you had green vests versus purple vests, oh my God, those would have sold.
Absolutely. But yeah, there's plenty of stuff, even without getting, I don't think we're ever going to see the Telepath War novels. I don't think we're ever going to see that story. That's just how I feel.
Maybe it's going to be a whole complete series that he's going to produce in his new studio.
Well, maybe.
Not to be overly morbid, but I imagine we'll find out. I believe JMS has left his whole estate to some university. So whenever, not to be overly morbid, but that would probably be when we find out what.
No, you serious? You know what? Doing a miniseries for one of the cable networks about the Telepath War, I could see that possibly happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be fine. I think any Babylon 5 is good Babylon 5, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, so. Except for maybe Voices.
Tim, Edmund.
I'll take Voices if it's well. I bought these novels after the end of the series because it's like, you know, I really want some more Babylon 5. I don't even mind Legend of the Rangers for all of its error problems.
Yeah, I actually bought them as they were coming out, which is probably the only reason I found them all. Same thing with the season guides by Jane Killick. I just saw them on the shelf. I'm like, oh, cool, more Babylon 5. And I just bought it with sight, literally. I didn't care. Anything that had Babylon 5 on it, I grabbed. The security manual when it came out, I grabbed it. I saw, what was it? Used copies of the British version of, was it Creating Babylon 5 and Babylon 5 A to Z? I grabbed those and I saw them. I mean, I saw them and I grabbed them. So,
I haven't. I never had any problems tracking these books down after they were out. At least the non-canon stuff.
No,
when it was out of publish.
The trilogies. All like the Telepath trilogy, the Centauri trilogy, and the Technomade trilogy were plentiful for about 6 months each, maybe.
Yeah, I grabbed those all when they originally came out.
Yeah, when they first came out, I'm like, oh, cool. Here's the first one. Here's the second one. Here's the third one. It never dawned on me that one book from the Centauri trilogy or one book from the Technomage trilogy would be impossible to find. Would go out of print.
Which is too bad, because that last book in both those trilogies is great.
Well, that's just it. It's not the last book in both of them. It's the last book in the Centauri trilogy that you can't find, and the second book of the Technomage trilogy that's out of print.
Still trying to find those, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I got a spare copy of Long Night of Centauri Prime, if you mail me your address, I can send it to you.
Is that the first one or the third one?
The third one.
Yeah. Okay. There you go, Jeremy. There's your copy. Tim?
I was going to fence it for, $50, but I guess I can give it to you.
Tim Edmund says, don't you dare rain on my Telepath War parade.
Sorry, if I'm not getting my Lensman movie, nobody gets their Telepath War.
Oh!
Everybody drink.
Oh, shit. I'll be right back.
All right. Anybody else have anything they want to add to this? I think we've pretty much talked about it.
You want to talk about the giant space worm and...
Oh, the touch of your shadow, the whisper of your name, which I think is the most engaging... the most Babylon 5-like title of the books. You know, the rest of them are these voices, accusations. They're like Next Generation titles.
Thank you. They are Star Trek Next Generation novel titles.
And they're written by Star Trek authors in a lot of cases, so it's not surprising.
Right. So The Touch of Your Shadow, The Whisper of Your Name is interesting, but it's also in a lot of ways it's interesting, because reading the... reading the write-up, there's a weird 9 million mile long spatial anomaly that shows up. It is kind of a lot like Third Space, and that
very
there's
third
this
space.
Weird telepathic presence that's causing people to kind of go crazy and do weird things. But I don't know. I just in the end, it's there's like space bikers, and there's...
Oh, yes, the space bikers. The worst part of this whole novel.
Here's another one. Oh, I don't know. I mean, here's the write-up about Lanier acting out his dreams. He puts on a loincloth and starts attacking people with a spear.
You don't think Lanier secretly wants to be Tarzan?
I thought he wanted to be...
Conan the Barbarian.
Wait, no. I thought he was acting out like some repressed fantasy that got jump-started when he was riding the Kawasaki Ninja with Garibaldi.
No, because then he's Garibaldi Spiker. Yeah.
The only other comment I was going to make about these books is the horrible covers.
Yes. Boy, talk about generic.
Yeah. And I did some looking up on this. Apparently the covers, Dell, when they were commissioning these books, they just had an artist mock up four covers for the first four. And someone asked, why is there a picture of Jakar on the second book? And it's because
Jakar in that book.
Yeah, Jakar's not even in the book. They just stuck him on the cover, and it fit, and they figured out, well, it doesn't really work for any other, so this is the one it gets stuck with. So, accusations gets...
Jakar sells books.
Yeah.
Now, what's really interesting is that when Del Rey picked up the Babylon 5 novels,
mm-hmm.
from they reprinted number 7 and number 9.
Yeah, and they updated the covers.
Where they updated the covers, and that's how I accidentally bought those two books again, because the covers were different. They took the number off. It had a different cover, and I'm looking at it, it's going, The Shadow Within, this is familiar. The Shadow Within. I know I have this already, but it looks completely the Shadow Within. I'm flipping through anything in the beginning that would help me say, and I didn't have my little app on my iPod Touch now that has most of my library in it, so I couldn't double check and, you know, not rebuy it. But I rebought both of those because they were different. I mean, they were both there. They were both different covers. I was looking. What was I looking for? I think I was looking for the Technomage book.
Yeah.
Or one of either Technomage or the Centauri book that because had just come out around that time.
Shadow Within kind of is a prequel to the Technomage trilogy. Mm-hmm. Not completely, but it is enough.
Yeah, and like I said, the covers were so vastly different, and the title of it, come on, didn't really stick with me at the time. So I'm looking at it going.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
And I'm like, this can't be the same book. So I bought those two books, and when I got home, I looked at the shelf, I'm like, son of a bitch, it is the same book. And I was like, why did Del Rey reprint these two and not the others? And then I'm like, well, I kind of understand why, but why did they? Well,
they knew. They knew we were going to do separate episodes on those two books.
That's it. No, my thing was
we're just discussing the covers in general, though.
Yeah, well, no, they
you can't really mention.
Well, but you have to wonder if they went with different covers for those two because.
Well, it wasn't their artwork. It wasn't their artwork, but I can understand. But there was no mention of the other books in the series at all. And if there had been a mention that, you know, this was book whatever of a series, even though it wasn't their series, I probably wouldn't have rebought them. But I don't mind rebuying them because I like the artwork better.
Yeah, no, I'm looking online here. They are significantly better. They're almost like photo montages rather than expressionless paintings. I think that I would also suggest that the reason there's no reference to the other novels is because these are now considered canon as opposed to upgraded fanfic or whatever you want to say about those original runs. So that I think is also what sets it aside that way.
Well, and I don't think I'd say calling it fanfic might be a little mean, but.
Well, yeah, okay. That's fair.
I feel some of the inconsistencies of these books are testament from when they are written, because we know more as an audience who have seen every episode of Babylon 5 than these authors did when they wrote it. And a lot of the things, you know, they just didn't know going forward, and JMS had no reason to tell them. So, I don't know, one of those things where I feel like they're not bad for what they are when they were written in that context, kind of like the comics.
Right. But so maybe to use a different analogy, maybe it's Charlie Brown's Christmas tree. You know, it's not such a bad trio after all. All it needs is a little love.
Works for me.
All right. All right, guys. Anything else?
Nope.
All right.
I think Jeremy, we've said everything that needs to be said about these books.
There you go.
All right. Let's wrap it up then. Next week, we will be talking about book 9.
Dream in the City of Sorrows, I believe.
Right. We are. Yes. We talked about flipping schedules, but we aren't.
Right.
There was just too much. Too many cats to be herded into too many different corrals, so we're just going to leave things be. So next week is The Dream in the City of Sorrows. The week after that will be The Shadow Within. So, as always...
Those will both be great shows, and you should check them out.
Tune in next week for... As always, the website is BabylonPodcast.com. The email address is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. You can send your comments in, your accusations of whatever you want to accuse Tim of. If you want to record your own voicemail messages, that is the place to send them. Or if you just want to call in your messages in between Gary and Neil, that phone number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year we discovered what super morbidium could really do.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Q-238 aluminum modulator or whatever.